People are busy. They don't have time to talk about climate change. Plus, it feels scary, especially when you're talking to your kids.
I don't want to talk to them so that much about it because I have so much personal anxiety about it. I don't want them to see that.
I'm Carol Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, why we need to talk about climate change even when we don't want to. Plus, an atmospheric scientist on why it's not bad form to discuss the relationship between hurricanes and other natural disasters and climate change.
It's happening right now. It's not something we think about as happening in the future. It's a current problem.
We're putting it all out there about climate change and more. Stay with us. How do you bring the history of the Underground Railroad alive for people today? How about a garden? When Samuel Black was putting together the From Slavery to Freedom exhibit at the Senator John Hines History Center, he found a hole in the literature.
There's very little mention of the experiences of runaway slaves in terms of the impact of natural environment.
So he did the research himself. He used slave narratives and other archival sources to gather information on about 50 plant species that played a role in the lives of enslaved people who traveled north looking for their freedom. And Black found a local partner in Pittsburgh to bring his work to life.
We have essentially created an outdoor, free, accessible museum exhibit.
That's Camilla Rivera Tinsley, the director of the Frick Environmental Center. The new From Slavery to Freedom garden is just beyond the entrance to Frick Park where the center is located. I joined Black and Rivera Tinsley there for a tour.
We are looking at 6 raised beds in total, and we chose the plants that really represented agency and sovereignty. There is a mix of plants that provided sustenance and food and were able to create market gardens for enslaved people that had gained their freedom. Cowpeas, you will find tomatoes, you will find collards, carrots, onions, all of the standard foodstuffs that we're used to.
I see you have one really nice butternut squash here.
Yeah, so we have a couple of different squash varieties that are in here. We really tried to focus on heirloom varieties. You know, the term heirloom just harkens to the fact that before we chose one or two varieties of every foodstuff that we eat, there were hundreds and hundreds of varieties of tomatoes to choose from, which are delicious and beautiful and also happen to be resistant to diseases.
Can you talk about some of the other plants that were useful to people who were on the Underground Railroad?
Some of those that I think that are surprising to people are plants like wild lettuce. We think of lettuce today that goes into a salad. Well, wild lettuce was primarily a herb that the enslaved used as, number one, a coffee substitute, but it also had an impact where it was sort of a cleanser. And it was used by runaway slaves. They would make a brew out of it and drink it, and especially women, because it would control their menses. And so you're looking to be at your optimum health if you were trying to escape slavery. And then various trees, and some trees, especially the oaks, the barks were used to help make shoes, for instance, the soles of shoes, or various medicines were made from the bark material as well. And of course, the hardwood was used to make furniture and tools and that type of thing. So there's various applications that the enslaved were using with some of these plants all along. And so when they found them in a natural environment, they were used to these types of plants. And they knew how to use it to make shelter, for weapons, to defend themselves. And that was the argument that I had, was the natural environment had to be the first challenge for a runaway slave. The second challenge were those coming after them who had hunting dogs and who were on horseback and so forth. So a runaway slave had to really be almost ingenious in how to survive in nature in order to survive the escape.
This is a celebration of their resourcefulness and their skill.
Yes, exactly. And that's what we really want to recognize here.
And do you feel like this has kind of been a lost history?
I would say more or less an overlooked history, where it was more or less focused on those who were conductors on the Underground Railroad or those who were successful in their escape from slavery, like Frederick Douglass. Even Frederick Douglass himself, he talked a lot more about what happened after he escaped slavery than what happened on his journey to freedom. I wanted to sort of put a face on the faceless. You know, those people who were part of the movement, who weren't necessarily historical names, everyday folk. You know, and when you consider what most historians talk about, something in the nature of about 30,000 people or so who made it successfully as runaways, most of the 30,000, we never know their names or never know who they were. And so I wanted to really dig deep.
So what are some of the other plants that we have growing here, or that will be growing here?
So we'll be putting in a plant called wild senna that, you know, if you are a fan of native plants, you may recognize its beautiful flower and the seed pod that is great food for wild animals. But wild senna is also really good for digestive issues. And so that's one of the ways that we can look at a plant and from many different angles and really use ethnobotany as a way to connect with people and connect people back to nature.
What would you most like people to take away from visiting this garden?
I would most like people to be able to just find a way to relate to nature on their own terms. I also really want people to walk away being inspired about the sense of agency that can come from knowledge of wild spaces around you, and knowing that that knowledge and those skills and that ability exist within all of us.
We want them to leave with a better understanding of the will to be free on the part of enslaved African Americans, and the ingenuity that they had in understanding the natural environment and how they could use the natural environment to sustain themselves and to make their trek to freedom.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Camilla Rivera Tinsley, the Director of Education and the Frick Environmental Center for the Pittsburgh Parks Conservancy, and Samuel Black, the Director of African American Programs at the Senator John Hines History Center. There's a lot more about their collaborative From Slavery to Freedom Garden at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapel.
Farms are economic drivers in our region. That means dairies, community-supported agriculture, and urban gardens are creating jobs. And that's why the economy is the theme of this year's Farm Aid concert that benefits family farms. You know Farm Aid. It features Willie Nelson, Neil Young, and a lot of other fan favorites. The concert has been held in Illinois, Nebraska, Texas, so why did they pick our region this time around?
Willie's answer is, well, we always want to go where we're wanted. And we feel extremely wanted here.
I'm Julie Grant. Join us next week for a discussion about how family farms are doing in our region and across the country. That's next week on the Allegheny Front.
Meteorologists and residents of the U.S. Virgin Islands and the Florida Keys called it a storm like they'd never seen before. Millions are still without power, and it might take years for some to recover from Hurricane Irma. The succession of natural disasters in the last weeks, Irma and Harvey in Texas and Louisiana, and the fires burning out west, have many people thinking about climate change. The science has become sophisticated enough now that much more is known about how climate change is and will be contributing to events like these. But amid the devastation of Hurricane Irma, EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt said it's not the time to talk about climate change. Is he right? Is it insensitive? Or is there something else going on here? To answer these questions on the latest episode of this week's Trump on Earth podcast, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier spoke with Ben Kirtman, a professor of atmospheric sciences at the University of Miami's Rosenstiel School for Marine and Atmospheric Sciences. Kirtman was in Atlanta, where he had evacuated from Hurricane Irma.
So let's talk about the effect of climate change on storms like Hurricane Irma and Harvey. Can you describe in a nutshell what we know about the relationship between climate change and these hurricanes?
Sure. There's two simple things to keep in mind here. The first is that the fuel for hurricanes is the ocean temperatures, the ocean surface temperatures. And as those temperatures warm, that means that fuel is more potent and can drive stronger storms. And as the climate system warms, those ocean surface temperatures are warming. The second thing to remember is as the atmosphere warms up, it can hold more water. What that means is when it holds more water, when you have a big storm, it wrings out more water. And so Harvey, for example, is a good example of a storm. Unfortunately, it stayed in one place, but because the atmosphere is able to hold more warm water, and because the it was nearby the Gulf of Mexico, which has very warm ocean temperatures, it was able to rain an enormous amount.
I understand that the Atlantic Ocean this year was about 1 to 2 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than normal.
That's right. The Atlantic Ocean was warmer than normal, and normal is getting warmer. You see, that's the climate change problem, is that the normal keeps getting warmer and warmer. And so the strongest storms are going to be stronger just because that fuel is more powerful. And it's a, not to be overly technical, it's a nonlinear effect. So a small increase in ocean temperatures corresponds to a big increase in evaporation, which is really of warm water from the ocean, which is the fuel that drives the storms.
So, but just to be clear, these hurricanes aren't caused by climate change. There probably would have been a Hurricane Irma or Hurricane Harvey even had there been no climate change.
Absolutely. There's no evidence whatsoever that any particular storm we can blame on climate change. It's absolutely true. But what we can say is Harvey may have been that much stronger, or Irma may have been that much stronger, or Harvey may have produced that much more rainfall. We can also say something about the statistics. So if Harvey, for example, was, say, 20 years ago, 1 in 100-year storm, the odds of getting Harvey are 1 in 100 in any one year. Well, then maybe today they're 1 in 25 of ever getting a Harvey. And maybe 10 years from today, it would be 1 in 10 years of ever getting a Harvey again. So the statistics of these strong storms are also likely changing as the climate warms.
So I want to go to something that Scott Pruitt, the EPA administrator, said to a couple of reporters in the last few days. He said that now is not the time to talk about climate change and its impacts on these storms. He's hardly the first person to say this. We hear this a lot when something really terrible like a mass shooting goes on. The idea is that by talking about the causes or factors that go into these events, that people are somehow politicizing it, exploiting a tragedy to prove some sort of political point. What do you think about it? Is now the time to talk about climate change and these storms?
Yeah, I do think it is the right time to talk about it, for a very important reason, is that when you think about how you want to recover from the storm and ensure that that recovery allows you to be more resilient in the face of another Harvey or another Irma, then you really do need to talk about climate change. What can we expect in the future from future storms is a critical element of how we make sure that our recovery ensures that we're resilient communities. That, when a big storm comes through, it may be scary, it may be damaging, but we recover quickly, very quickly. That's what resiliency is all about. And so for me, I think this is the ideal time as we start embarking on the recovery to think about how we do that to ensure that we are, in fact, as resilient as possible.
Now, your governor, Rick Scott, he's been on the TV a lot lately. He is not a big, believer in the idea that we're warming the climate with our carbon dioxide emissions. He's been labeled a climate change skeptic. What can you tell me about what he said about climate change and what impact you think that might have had or will have on how Florida reacts to these storms?
So from one perspective, the way to think about climate change in Florida is that it's happening right now. It's not something we think about as happening in the future. It's a current problem. And the boots on the ground, the city planners, the managers, they all have to deal with this problem today. It's not going to go away. And they're not too concerned about the debate about whether it's caused by human activities or not. They're coming to the realization that the trends they see today show no signs of reversing themselves. There's no scientific evidence whatsoever that the sea level rise we see today is going to stop. And so they have to respond. And for them, this debate over whether humans are involved or not is a little bit silly. They don't think on that time horizon. So what I think is they're focusing on trying to avoid the silliness in the debate and figure out how are they going to garner resources to make sure, Miami Beach is able to deal with sea level rise. And so in some sense, Governor Scott's position about climate change is a bit of a hurdle that they've just figured out how to get through or over in terms of making sure their communities are resilient.
Ben Kirtman is a professor of atmospheric sciences at the University of Miami's Rosenstiel School for Marine and Atmospheric Sciences. The Allegheny Friends' Reed Frazier caught up with him by phone in Atlanta, where Kirtman himself was sheltering from Hurricane Irma. The other half of their conversation is on our Trump on Earth podcast at trumponearth.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Trump on Earth is a co-production with Point Park University's Environmental Journalism Program. That's trumponearth.org. According to polls, more and more Americans do accept the science about climate change than ever before. But most people still rank climate change as a low priority. The hosts of WBEZ Chicago's Nerdette podcast talk about science a lot, so they took on this challenge. Talk to Chicago families about climate change and find out why this subject, which many of us know is so important, is still so easy to ignore. For WBEZ's Heat of the Moment series, which explores stories about everyday life on a changing planet, Greta Johnson and Trisha Bobita take it from here.
Kids today may have to deal with the blunt, brutal effects of climate change in their lifetime. But we wondered, is this something families are talking about around the kitchen table? How do parents explain it? How do kids respond?
So Greta and I found 13 families from all over Chicago and convinced them to let us into their homes. Before we arrived, the only thing we told them is we wanted to talk about the future. They were smart, they were engaged, and they were very generous to let us waltz into their living rooms with our microphones and intrude on their weekends.
They really were. Trisha and I talk to scientists a lot on our show, but we are not the experts. So we asked Heidi Cullen to ride shotgun.
Hi, my name is Heidi Cullen. I'm a climate scientist.
Heidi also runs a website called Climate Central, and she has a particular mission: to get people to act on what we know from science.
I often think of this quote by Sherry Rowland, a Nobel Prize-winning chemist, and he said, "What's the point of having developed a science well enough to make predictions if in the end all we do is stand around and wait for them to come true?" And I'm really worried that that's what we're going to do with climate change.
In late August, Heidi Cullen flew out from New Jersey for a two-day road trip to meet the families.
I'm going to turn left on Damon.
And yes, we get the irony of all this driving.
Let's start with Nyssa Holtkamp. She lives a little west of Andersonville with her 8-year-old son named William and her 6-year-old named...
My name is Leslie.
Hi, Rosalie.
Want to try to say something, though? You can't have food while you're talking into the mic, okay?
We gathered around the table. We brought supplies. The kids got paper and crayons, and we asked them if they would draw a picture of the future.
And Heidi brought facts about climate change.
Chicago, in the Midwest.
Like, if we do nothing to curb carbon emissions, heat-related deaths are predicted to quadruple in our lifetime. Food will get more expensive, and people living near the coast will have to flee rising sea levels.
So I think what we see is a future of more extreme heat, of more extreme rainfall events, the kind of thing that we saw in Louisiana and in West Virginia. Those kinds of really heavy rainfall events, we're already seeing them happen more often.
As Heidi painted this pretty grim picture for Nyssa about the problems climate change could cause by the time her kids were grown up, I noticed William scribbling dark circles next to me. When he was done, he nudged the paper in front of us.
It said, "Everyone disintegrated 200 years later."
At the bottom are 10 little black piles of ash with eyes poking out. I looked over at his mom.
I guess I wasn't prepared for that. Even though he's not really talking about it too much, the first thing that he decided to draw was everybody in ashes. So obviously there's, you know, he's having a very visceral reaction to it.
This wasn't an easy moment for Nyssa. She teared up. It reminded her of another conversation with William.
He just looked at me and said, "You know, one day I will die." And I was like, "Yeah, I know, honey. I know." And he kind of looked at me and had this like kind of, you know, like I think he was kind of coming to terms with that and what it is to be mortal and to have, kind of have your children realize that and watch them realize that is tough. And I think I'm kind of having the same sort of situation here, you know?
Nissa said that she was worried that fear could make her son feel hopeless, apathetic even.
I don't want to talk to them that much about it because I have so much personal anxiety about it. I don't want them to see that.
And there's some social science that backs her up here. Heidi calls it pre-traumatic stress disorder, and it's a common reaction to information about climate change. When people get so afraid of the future,
they just shut down. This is our first takeaway. Getting up close and personal with climate change predictions can be really uncomfortable and difficult because people are scared, and we tend to avoid the things we're afraid of.
And not just scared, sad. After almost an hour of talking with another family, the dad said, yeah, climate change is important. But would he think and talk about it more after having Heidi at his kitchen table?
Nope.
No, because if he did, he'd walk around depressed all the time.
It's almost like a different way to deny the impact of climate change. It's a camp a lot of us fall into, and I can totally relate to it. Not disbelieving the science, just avoiding it.
We left Nissa's house and drove south, towards the Calumet Heights neighborhood, near 92nd Street, to meet Constance Benson and her two grandsons, Josh, who's 14, and Kevin, who's 15. They'd spent the morning at church, where Constance works and Josh plays the drums. By the time we got to her house, it had turned into a sticky, sweltering August afternoon.
If we turned off the fan, would it be too brutal in here?
I'm okay if you guys are, just because it's probably making a noise.
It's making a lot of...
Constance was in Chicago in 1995 when about 750 people died in a heat wave. Heidi told Constance that by the end of the century, thanks to climate change, a heat wave of that magnitude could happen 3 times a year.
Constance listened to what we had to say, and then she told her grandsons it might be time to bring back an environmental program at their church that had petered out. She also told us about this book she was reading, Jesus and the Disinherited. It's by a theologian named Howard Thurman, and it talks about how hard it is to focus on the long game when you're scrambling in the here and now.
One of the things he talked about, he's talking about that individuals who are at a certain level of society that are dealing with day-to-day existence matters. Will I have enough food? Will I have a place to stay? That for individuals like that, the whole matter of day-to-day existence sometimes takes precedence over thinking about how do even we plan for our lives in the future.
Do you feel like you can relate to that?
I have felt like I can relate to that more lately than in the past.
As a retiree on a fixed income, money is tight, and she's worried about keeping her grandson safe.
One day we were at church and the kids were coming home from school walking down 72nd Street. Someone came along and fired a shot. You know, we went running outside and so on. And a kid had gotten shot in the leg, I believe it was. I think Kevin knew the boy.
I think your point about when people are just trying to get through the day and figure out if they've got, you know, enough food on the table for their family, it unfortunately is as with so many of these big problems we face, you know, in Chicago and all over the world, the people who are in that position are going to be the first to feel climate change in their real life, and they're going to be hit the hardest by it, right?
People who can't necessarily afford to think about it now.
Mm-hmm.
And here is takeaway number 2. Most families did think climate change was important, but they're leading busy, hectic lives. And day to day, they just don't have the mental energy for more worry. Violent streets, paying bills, getting through school, the election, with so many other things vying for their attention. Almost everyone said climate change just wasn't a topic they could prioritize.
Social scientists say it's like there's a finite pool of worry, and we can only fit so much stuff into it. This all makes sense, but it also raises a tough question.
Right. Like, okay, people like Heidi Cullen have gotten good enough at science to figure out we are wrecking the planet. But if they can't get enough other people to care, then what good does it do to know?
Well, my name's Alicia Viola Zimmerman, and I'm 9.
And you want to introduce yourself to us?
No, thanks.
Since he doesn't want to introduce himself, I'll tell you this is Alex. He and Alicia are the kids of Andy and Amy Zimmerman. They're the sort of family who puts up laminated world maps and posters behind their kitchen table, the kind you'd expect to see in an elementary school classroom. And right off the bat, before we even told them we wanted to talk about climate change, the kids brought it up.
Well, I don't want the Earth to go away. I've become fond of it.
It's a good place. Yeah. It's a nice place to live. It's not like we have a lot of other options, right?
Yeah. Until the habitable zone moves to another planet, I'm staying here.
Amy says the first time she realized her kids were thinking about climate change was when Alex was 4. He drew this machine that he said could eat CO2 out of the air to stop global warming.
This is, I think, what's drawn him to wanting to be an inventor is that he has got some ideas about how to fix some of the problems.
You're telling away his trade secrets, though.
I know.
I'll be underneath the table if you need me. It's okay.
There are plenty of big questions about how to handle climate change. Things that seem too hard, too far away, too late to fix, too big for any one of us to take on. The Zimmermans were still struggling with how to think about climate change solutions. So Heidi jumped in with a question for the family.
I guess, you know, on this issue of being realistic versus optimistic, I'm just curious, like, I mean, do you guys actually think we're going to fix it? We're going to make it happen?
Oh, you have to. You have to. I mean, you have to see that as a yes. You have to see that as by the skin of our teeth. You know, I mean, you can't, I don't know. Voldemort can't win. Like, you know, that cannot be the answer.
Okay, for anyone who's not familiar with Voldemort, he's the bad guy in the Harry Potter series. So when Amy says Voldemort can't win, she's saying we can't let climate change destroy the Earth. That can't be how this story ends.
Heidi is quick to agree. And she thinks there's also something we can do right at our kitchen tables. Even if it's complicated, even if it's kind of a bummer, we can keep talking.
How does talking help? Remember the bad guy from Harry Potter? Most people called him He Who Shall Not Be Named.
There's a power to calling the problem you need to conquer by its name. That's what Heidi was eager to tell the families.
I think there's actually so much good stuff happening. You know, there's so many people thinking about how to make like the most efficient solar cell and how to store energy that comes from the sun and the wind. So I think there's plenty of reasons to think that we could, you know, nip this in the bud. We just need everyone talking about it.
In other words, Voldemort can't win. So let's keep talking. For WBEZ, I'm Trisha Bobita.
And I'm Greta Johnson.
Thanks to WBEZ Chicago for that story. And for more Heat of the Moment stories about everyday life on a changing planet, go to AlleghenyFront.org. Thank you for listening to The Allegheny Front. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of The Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. Heat of the Moment is funded by the Joyce Foundation, working to improve quality of life, promote community vitality, and achieve a fair society. The Joyce Foundation at joycefdn.org.